I still remember the state capitals B. I was in about the third grade, and we were lined up, boy, girl, like they always put us against the chalkboard, waiting for our turn. When we were up, our teacher, who was the beautiful, gentle Miss Deschler, who I just adored, she had this thick brown hair and these beautiful dark brown eyes. She looked like a princess. She would call out the name of a state, Washington, and whoever was up would say the capital, Olympia. And if you got it right, you got to go on to the next round, but if you missed it, you had to sit down. And you were out of the B, and my stomach was just fluttering with anxiety. I didn't want to sit down because Eric Schobel, who was my biggest rival in soccer and in school, had already gone. He had passed on to the next round with Georgia, Atlanta, which I hadn't even known. And if I lost this round, I would have to sit down with the other embarrassed, sad-looking kids, and Eric would make fun of me all the way home on the bus. It was my turn, and my palms were sweaty, and my heart was thumping, and my nose was so sweaty, my glasses wouldn't stay up. I had plastic, big plastic 80s glasses. And I nodded at the teacher that I was ready, and she said, Louisiana. And I said, that's a state. Huh. I hadn't realized. Louisiana. And I panicked, and Miss Deschler, being the nicest person on the face of the planet, gives me this, like, you can do it look, as if it was just confidence and not actually me having no idea that there was a state named Louisiana. And so she tried to help me. I remember this so distinctly. She tried to help me by going like this, because the capital of Louisiana is Baton Rouge. But my mom didn't wear makeup, and I didn't know that rouge was blush. And so I said, cheek comb? Because it looked like she was combing her cheek. I'm extroverted, so things just come out when I think them. And so cheek comb, it was really embarrassing. And everyone laughed, of course, especially Eric. And Eric, we were in the third grade, and he'd already figured out how to smirk. He was so ahead of the game. He was smirking at me, and my eyes welled up. And I just fantasized that I could run out the door of the hall, run out of the classroom and down the hallway and just run all the way home, even though it was pretty far, so that I wouldn't have to be at school anymore that day. And I started telling a new story about myself that year, the story that I wasn't good at school. I was good at school before third grade, but we'd been in a different school district and we switched, and I wasn't smart in this new school. It turned out I wasn't smart after all. It was confusing, and it was a story that really stuck in my head. I went all the way through high school believing that I was bad at school. And then I went to college, and I got all A's because I studied constantly, furiously. I studied 12 hours a day. But I was sure that I would be caught out as not smart and that I would be kicked out of the school because somehow, even though I had A's, they would know, like, I wasn't good at school. We're all full of stories, these layers upon layers of tales that we tell about ourselves. I lack rhythm, I tell myself, because once when I was in a high school band, I tried to play the tambourine along with a Beatles song, and I couldn't match the beat, and people laughed. So I lack rhythm, because 20 years ago, I once tried to play a percussion instrument. I told my friend that story, and she said, do you want a side of fries with that extra large helping of craziness? A long time ago, humans evolving over the centuries figured out this weird thing. We're alive, and eventually we won't be alive, and we don't know what happens after that, and we don't know what happened with us before we were born. So why do we exist, and for what purpose? So people made up all these really creative stories about God to describe what they felt might be going on. And these stories were made up by people just like us, and they say probably more about the people telling the story than they say about God. And they were just stories. They weren't supposed to be taken literally. It was just people trying to figure something complicated out. And like all stories, they had an extra large helping of crazy right along with them. Now, a caveat, I'm not saying that humans made up God. Just the stories we tell about God are made up by human beings. There might be a God and there might not be, and you'll be the first ones to know if I figure it out. But in the meantime, I wouldn't trust anyone who says they know for sure what God thinks. So we created God to match our own brand of crazy. In cultures that inherited the Christian story, there were conflicting stories, and our modern denominations come from deciding which stories count and which stories to just get rid of, which stories to discard, which stories are important and which we should ignore. There's no faith that uses every story in their canon. There's no Christianity that refuses to wear blended fibers as prohibited in Leviticus. And there's no, as far as I know, Christian branch that really wants you to kill your disobedient child, like it says in Proverbs, John, and Exodus. Each faith chose their canon, their own grab bag of stories about God that were the keepers. And the Europeans who took over the United States, who founded our government, were mostly Calvinist Christians, with a few Unitarians thrown in. Calvinists who believed that humanity was at root bad, that people were bad and sinful and rotten and born that way. And if it wasn't for God and the leadership of the very few people, men, chosen by God, we would be helpless to resist our fundamental evilness. Calvinism isn't a branch of Christianity you see around much anymore, but it's in the very air of our culture. Our prison system is based on this idea that we are unreformable and we have to be locked away like animals that might bite people. We have to be locked away. And early psychology saw humans as a mass of dark impulses fighting with each other. The greatest hits of our literary canon, all those books they made you read in 9th and 10th grade English class, were all about people trying to overcome their inherent vice. So Universalists, which are our forebears, were the exception to the popular Calvinist interpretation of God's relationship with humanity. Well, eventually, Universalists believed in the universality of God, that God was found in many world faiths. Initially, they were a Christian denomination, and Universalists believed that God adored us because we were inherently lovable and not always perfect, but inherently pretty awesome. And when we weren't awesome, it was because of society. It was because we lacked good role models, or we didn't have enough to eat, or we had poor education, inequality, not anything we were born with, but just ways in which life let us down. Universalists were inspired by the love of mothers, everyday mothers who love their children even when they wake up crying four times in one night. Mothers who love their children when they throw the football inside the house and break their favorite lamp. And of course, not all mothers are loving, and I'm sorry if that's true for you. I know it's true for a lot of people. And of course, sometimes moms have to set boundaries with their children, and even awesome moms lose their patience on a daily basis. Dads too. So I don't want to make motherhood an impossible pedestal, but overall, your everyday mother love is pretty impressive stuff. So Universalists said, this is weird. Most mothers love their children endlessly and patiently and enduringly, and if a mom can do that, shouldn't we think God can do that? Isn't it kind of weird that God can't love us as much as our moms can? Why are preachers saying that God lost patience with us and that God is so ticked off that we're going to suffer forever into eternity after we die? Shouldn't we expect that God could forgive us as much as our moms could forgive us? So this was pretty wild and crazy theology at the time. Back then, people still thought that women had little tiny brains and were more like children than like men. But Universalists said, all that emotional stuff women do is really good. And it's holy and it's sacred. And our stories about God should have more of that and less of the angry war God. What we say about God should make God as good as your average mother. Now, this was crazy theology then, but now it seems kind of obvious. So Universalism was this little tiny denomination, mostly in the South and in the West, where they were settling the West. And it wasn't a powerful group, but they changed the way that all Protestants think about God, because Universalist ideas were really popular and they were adopted by other denominations. And now you don't hear so much about the angry God of Calvinism, but you hear a lot about God the parent, God the father who loves us no matter what. So even if we don't believe in God, particularly the stories that we tell about holiness, sacredness, and the nature of humanity matter. They influence how we look at ourselves. What stories do you tell about you? I know that my self-told stories can be really harsh, that there are things that I would never say to other people, that I wouldn't say to a friend. I believed I was bad at school and, you know, therefore dumb for 20 years. And that story hurt me. It hurt me and it changed my ambitions. It changed what opportunities I went for. You know, I always thought it'd be amazing to be a Rhodes Scholar, but I never even applied because I wasn't smart enough to do things like that. There were so many opportunities like that that I just assumed being dumb I couldn't do. These stories really hurt, and they could have kept me from going to seminary. Our stories about God also give us the impression that there's going to be some kind of a test, that at the end of our lives, if not sometime before, we're going to be held to some standard that's like this official universal standard that everybody else is above, but somehow we're not as good as, and that then we're going to fail, and that everybody will know that we failed this mysterious test. And how many times have you thought that? Like, I am failing at parenting. I am failing at adulthood today. Today I get an F in being an adult. Today I get an F in being a friend or a spouse. But my dear spiritual companions, there's no test and there's no grade, and you wouldn't fail even if there was. You're doing great. These self-made stories really matter. We wound ourselves over and over again hard with these stories. I'm thoughtless, I'm a bad parent, I'm not smart enough, I'm selfish. No one will ever be attracted to me. It hurts. We wound ourselves again and again. But how can we stop it? Do we want to stop it? I'm afraid that somewhere along the line, we started to believe that all this self-abuse was good for us, that without it, that we would become wild hedonists, without guilt, without a moral compass, without compassion for other people. But that's not how it works. Buddhists in monasteries, cloistered monks and nuns from millions of traditions over hundreds of years, have lived with this goal of dismantling their self stories. Because if you can't see yourself clearly through all your stories, how can you see God? How can you see the world? So these monastics spend entire chunks of their lives trying to dismantle these self stories. And when they're done, they don't become wild hedonists. They become incredibly compassionate people who have this power to do good in the world because they're not bogged down thinking, I shouldn't say this out loud because I'm stupid, you know? If you think of your cell phone battery life, you know, on your the little battery on your phone, if you're using 40% of your energy every day to beat yourself up, there's not much left for helping other people or being creative or being productive. So we're going to ditch these stories, and it's going to be three steps, and they're not very easy. I'm not going to lie, but it's only three. So it's going to take years to undo these harmful narratives, but we might as well start now because there's this whole world out there that we're missing because we're really busy telling ourselves we're not good enough. So step one, let's say this just happened to me yesterday. Let's say you're turning right in your car and there's a person in the crosswalk, you're turning right on red, and there's somebody in the crosswalk, but you didn't see him because it's like raining and it's super gray and it's being very Seattle outside. And you don't hit them or anything, you're not even close to them, but they give you this look and this gesture like, what are you, blind, you know? And you feel bad. And to yourself, you think, I'm such a jerk. Like, why don't I ever notice anything? I'm so out of it. Like, am I so self-absorbed that I'm gonna like hit a pedestrian at some point? Jeez, major fail. All right, so you made a mistake. Now, if a friend of yours was telling you this story, they would say, it's an accident. We all rush too much. It's no big deal. This person didn't die, you know? But heaven forbid you're as nice to yourself as your friends are. No, you have to beat yourself up, at least if you're me. So when you catch yourself in the act of beating yourself up, I want you to do something that's gonna feel really silly, but it works, and you don't have to do it out loud, but just stick with me. You're gonna put your hand on your heart, just, and feel it beat, and say to yourself, I'm sorry. Because that's the least you would say to a friend if you said something crappy to them. I'm sorry. Just apologize to yourself. And then in this part, you're gonna roll your eyes, just fair warning. Say, I'm sorry. and I love you.
I know, right? Tough stuff. I love you. Now, maybe you can't say I love you to yourself today. That's okay. We'll get there, right? Say, I like you. Say, I respect you. Say, I love you, but roll your eyes and just fake it till you make it, right? you know, I'm sorry and you're okay sometimes. That'll work for now. But we're working toward I'm sorry and I love you. That's the goal. And I didn't make this up. The psychologist and Buddhist Tara Brach made this up, and she came up with this. And I've been practicing it for a while, and I have to say it's really profound. It's really changed the way I talk to myself. And I have to say, I'm saving so much time, like not beating myself up. I have all this time to notice other things in the world. And I feel better about myself and all that. So why not be my own friend, you know? I mean, even maybe someday my own best friend. I'm going out on a limb. So the first step is going to take a while. It's going to take months. But your stories every day are going to start to dissipate. And it feels like that. It feels like a rock in your chest that sort of breaks down. Like the poem we read, the ground just sort of breaks open and it starts to just float away. It's nice. It just kind of rushes off. And the stories, they start to seem funny after you start to notice them. This Zen teacher, John Tarrant, writes about a woman who was really hard on herself because she had a speech impediment, and once in a great while she stuttered. I mean, this wasn't like every second or anything, but she was so ashamed of herself that she told herself she should never speak in public, even like if she was at lunch with a group of her friends. Like, she didn't talk much at all. And she started doing this exercise and realized that this was a story she was telling about herself, that she shouldn't talk, she shouldn't talk, she shouldn't talk. And it struck her as funny because she had spent so much time abusing herself over this speech impediment. These hours of her life were gone. And so she decided to amplify her shame instead of squashing it. So she would say, like, I'm going to talk in public now, guys. Like, I know I'm probably going to stutter. And, you know, I also have a big nose and I'm short. And I should probably lose 20 pounds. So everybody stone me. You know, she was just really... She was really funny about it, and because of that, people started to realize their own self stories, and through that, you know, that amplification, she stopped being ashamed of this tiny thing that was a problem for her. The shame lost all its power, and that's probably what's going to happen for you. That's what happens with me now. These stories seem really humorous, because once we examine our stories, they're pretty silly. I don't have rhythm because once, 20 years ago, I picked up her tambourine for 30 seconds and wasn't good at it. Like, what does that have to do with anything? It's ridiculous. As your stories fade away or you laugh them out of your system, you begin to see the essence of who you really are. Under all your tales about how awful you are, you start to notice fundamentals. I am compassionate under all that junk. I am resilient. I am hopeful. This is the second step. I just want you to notice what's good about you at your fundamental essence. Not, I'm good at the New York Times crossword puzzle, because in the big picture, it doesn't really matter. But I'm a nice person. I'm patient. Just appreciate yourself. Just like the religious denominations got to choose what stories they picked for their religious canon, you get to pick what about you is worth keeping, what about you is really true and worth holding on to, and you get to discard the rest of it, just like religious groups have for hundreds of years. What stories belong in the Bible of you? The third step is going to be really easy or really hard, depending on who's around you. But it's the last step. So who are your family and friends, and what do they mirror back to you? Let's think about the kid's story today about the tiger. This person kept telling him he was weak and he couldn't get out, and he believed it. You know, no matter how much work you do on yourself, if you're surrounded by people that tear you down all the time, that tell you you're worthless or stupid or no good, then you're going to believe it, unfortunately. So start thinking about who your mirrors are. It's like a fun house in there, isn't it? Just mirrors reflecting back from a million different angles. Everyone you know is giving you some perspective on who you are. So what are the people closest to you, the mirrors you look in the most, what are they reflecting? Do they reflect that fundamental essence of goodness? Or are they reinforcing some old story about you that probably wasn't true to begin with? Does your partner, your best friend, your parents, Do they echo back who you really are, or some old shame story that you tell yourself? How distorted is the picture? How outdated is their view? In some cases, we can choose our mirrors. You can break up with a hurtful boyfriend. You can drift away from a toxic friend. But if we're talking about someone you can't stop being around, like a parent you have to take care of, then be conscious of how their words impact you. Be really aware of how you feel after you talk to them. Talk to them about it if you can, if they're a person that can understand things like that. But mostly remember that they're shooting back an image of you that isn't true and that it's just like a funhouse mirror. I went in a funhouse when I was in Transylvania, and it's a kind of a disturbing experience, but I looked in this mirror and I was like 8 feet tall and like, you know, maybe 3 pounds. And I didn't believe the mirror. Like, I knew it was a funhouse. So when you're with these people, think, you know, this is just the funhouse. Like, I'm not 8 feet tall. It's not true. How outdated is their picture? How distorted? Remember, you have fundamental goodness, and they don't get to decide how good you are, or who you are, even. They don't get to decide whether you're a worthy human being who would pass this fictional test that doesn't exist. You don't have to live in the funhouse. So try to be around people that reflect who you really are, these essential qualities of you. This is the thing, and this is good old-time religion from the Universalists. You are good. Like, deep down at your root, under all that garbage that you tell yourself or that other people have told you, teachers and friends and parents and girlfriends, you're good. You're all good. At your core, you're a good person. I promise. And things have happened to you in your life that maybe made you do things that you regret doing or that you wish you hadn't done. And a lot of that was probably really bad circumstances. And if the world was a better place, you probably wouldn't have done it in the first place. Because at your root, you're a good person. When you choose a congregation, you get to choose, what stories do I believe about the universe and life and God? And I know that's a decision a lot of you took really seriously and really researched what congregation to join. And now that you have the perfect congregation, it's time to, no, I'm just kidding, I'm sorry. Now that you have the perfect congregation, it's time to choose what you believe about you, what's in your own canon, what's in your own Bible. You did all that research to find a church. Let's do some mucking about in there and find out who you are. Just like stories about God, it's a bad idea to try to believe everything that's been thrown at you about who you are. So this month we're discussing gratitude. And I just want us to try to be grateful for us, for you. You be grateful for you, and I'll be grateful for me. I'm going to be grateful for the person I see in the mirror. I'm going to love myself, and I'm going to forgive myself. And I hope you'll join me. I'm going to try to be aware of the essence of who I am. I'm going to try to surround myself with people that can see how good I am. And I hope you'll surround yourself with people who see how amazingly awesome you are too.